This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and global war correspondent and author of the political critique, Death of the Liberal Class. Over the past year, Hedges has worked as an activist and organizer for the Occupy Wall Street movement. His column on current affairs appears weekly at the news journalism website, truthdig.com. TruthDig recently held its first annual retreat in Santa Fe, where Hedges delivered a keynote address on America's current condition of corporate control, which he calls inverted totalitarianism. Hedges also addressed the tactics of high finance, propaganda, permanent warfare, and the Occupy movement.
There's a really great Canadian philosopher I admire very much named John Ralston Saul, and I urge you to take time to read his work. Voltaire's Bastards was a very important book for me, along with another book by Patrick and Ralph Nader. Both gave me the book at almost the same time, and that's Sheldon Wolin's Democracy Incorporated. If I had to pick two books of sort of political philosophy, contemporary political philosophy, that I think are vital, those would be the two. And Saul deals with the breakdown of globalization, the lies, and Bob's written a lot about this, the lies that the proponents of globalization, which he correctly calls a utopian ideology, has sold to the rest of us. He calls the period of time that we live in one of those moments in history where we have yet to formulate new ideas by which we can live and function and are clinging to those dead ideas that people like Thomas Friedman popularize and perpetuate, but which with even minimal examination are exposed as utterly bankrupt and mendacious. I mean, all of the promises of globalization have in fact turned out to be untrue. And Wolin's book, Democracy Incorporated, I think describes correctly that we no longer live in a functioning democracy, that we live in a system that he calls inverted totalitarianism. And by that, he means it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. That in inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, and the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet internally have seized all of the levers of power as to render the citizen impotent. John Ralston Saul calls it a coup d'etat in slow motion, a line I steal and rarely credit. But I think that's right. And I think part of the problem that we have is that the sophistication of the public relations industry is such that we, even those of us who are literate and thoughtful, are made to confuse, or we confuse how we are made to feel with knowledge. And I think that both Wolin and Saul expose the structures of power. And you can't respond rationally to what's happening unless you understand where power is centered. And it's not centered in the personal narratives of political candidates, I believe. It's not centered in the Republican or the Democratic parties. It's centered in Wall Street. And both parties are captive to Wall Street. And I think I did not support Obama in 2008. And it was largely because of my relationship with two people. One was Dennis Kucinich, who you heard on Monday, who smelled Obama out really early. And Dennis said, you have to look at Obama's voting record in the Senate. It's 2 years of one corporate giveaway after another. And Dennis said, you know, when he was a kid, he went to the baseball games in Cleveland, and they'd be ushers up and down the aisle going, get your scorecard, get your scorecard. I'm imitating Dennis. And he said, you know, you got to look statistically at what these people do. And I think that that inability to sort of shut off the noise machine and look at what's happening has been very effective, or the noise machine has been very effective in deluding many of us, or at least masking where the real centers of power lie. And I don't believe that we're going to be effective until we confront those centers of power, which is why I have been very involved in the Occupy movement. And in the book I write, Death of the Liberal Class, there's a kind of backstory to that book, actually. It started out, and it's a good lesson for anyone who wants to be a writer, never write someone else's idea. The Knopf had, which is a big publisher, so my agent was sort of salivating because they have big money, asked me to write a book on the press. And I thought, well, you know, and I didn't want to do it. And I gave a talk at the Ford Foundation with my former foreign editor, who was then the executive editor of the New York Times, Bill Keller. And then Ford said, oh, we think it's a great idea. We'll even give you a grant to write it. So that's when I couldn't turn it down. And I did write it, and I turned it into Knopf. And Knopf, the editor Knopf, read it, and he hated it. And Knopf said, well, we'll print it, but we're going to assign an editor to take out all the negativity. And of course, what they wanted was the mythical version of the without fear and favor, Watergate, Pentagon Papers, the Fourth Estate. And I actually, you know, happen to believe that the demise of the traditional press, and especially newsprint, is catastrophic for our democracy, what's left of it. But I'm not about to lie on behalf of the institution, and I certainly understand the institution far better than the editors of Knopf. In fact, the editor who was assigned to this book was spending most of his time out there standing outside Tony Blair's office with a tape recorder ghostwriting Tony Blair's memoirs, for which Knopf had paid $4 million. And so I called the Nation books. When you get an advance, you get half of it up front. So I got Nation to just write a check for the money that I had already been paid and take the book. So Knopf, instead of allowing Knopf to excise the negativity, they just got a check for what they paid, and I took the manuscript back. And in the course of that process of transition, I thought, you know, it's not just the press that's collapsed, but all of the fundamental pillars of the liberal establishment, the liberal church that I come out of, liberal religious institutions, including synagogues, and I mean, you know, where are the Abraham Heschels, the culture, which has been completely decimated and commercialized. I had a great Irish writer as a professor in college, John McGarren, we were just talking about with Patrick, was in Ireland when he died, and he said, you know, it was on the front page of all the papers in Ireland. There's still in Europe an understanding that cultural patrimony is something vital to the health of a nation. The destruction of labor, the destruction of the Democratic Party. And so I said, I'll write about the collapse of all of these pillars that once made a democracy possible. And I should say that, and Bob's right, I come out of the religious left. The heroes in my house when I grew up were figures like Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King, who was, if you look closely at King, a radical, the Berrigans, and on June 7th, Dan Berrigan and I, Dan Berrigan's going to join us for a protest in New York. We have been, after the New York City police pushed everyone out of Zuccotti, we held a demonstration and tried to occupy a vacant lot that is owned by Trinity Church in New York. Trinity Church is the third or fourth largest landowner in Manhattan. It has $30 billion worth of property. It's the landlord for Goldman Sachs. It brings in $30 million a year in revenue. The rector of Trinity Church, Cooper, his title is rector of Trinity Church and CEO of Trinity Corporation. And there's a wonderful clip on YouTube of my friend George Packard, retired Episcopal bishop, man, is about 250 pounds of him too, climbing up a ladder on that cyclone fence and jumping over. And so about 60 people were arrested. And Trinity won't drop the charges. And Packard was arrested on May 1st with a group of Veterans for Peace when on the May Day demonstrations, several of the occupiers congregated at the Vietnam Memorial down in Lower Manhattan. Well, it turns out Packard was a platoon leader in Vietnam, a lieutenant, had a breakdown after the war. There were a lot of killing. He set up mostly night ambushes and became a priest because of it. There was a sort of, you know, in the usual confusion of Occupy, a call by some people to hold the park. Others didn't hold, but Packard and about 12 members from Veteran Peace, and I remember one of the, you know, now Packard's already up because Packard's got to go to trial on June 11th. If he gets picked up again, then he faces 3 months in jail. And I just talked to George, and, you know, he's ready to go. And I remember one of the leaders of the Occupy movement said, Bishop Packard, if they arrest you again, you're 3 months. And Packard said, I'm not going anywhere. I put names on that wall. And he didn't, and they did arrest him. but Dan's coming down and we're holding a demonstration to ask Trinity Church to drop the charges, which they won't do. Because if Trinity Church will drop the charges against these protesters, then there won't be a trial. We're going to have a day of fasting and prayer on the steps of Trinity Church, and then this was my idea. I thought we would go over to Rector Cooper's lavish penthouse and hold a Vespers service and serve the Eucharist in front of his doormen. When I began writing this book, I wondered, you know, what is it that went wrong? How did we end up where we are? And it led me back to World War I and the figure of Woodrow Wilson. I just finished teaching a course in a prison. It's in New Jersey. They segregate the prisons by gang affiliation, so these were all Bloods. And I taught them Leon Littwack's two great, great works, After the Storm, The Aftermath of Slavery, and then his great book on Jim Crow, Trouble in Time, which comes from a Muddy Waters song. But I remember reading in that book that even someone as brilliant and aware as W.E.B. Du Bois voted for Wilson in the belief that this was the practical thing to do. And you know, the first thing Wilson did, or one of the first things he did, was resegregate government offices. And of course, it was a decision that Du Bois deeply regretted, walking out on Debs. And so Wilson decides that he will rule or impose order through the traditional coercive mechanisms of legislation, most specifically the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act. And Lippmann says no. He said, in fact, we can create a system of mass propaganda where you will only have to use the Sedition Act and the Espionage Act selectively against those few dissidents who refuse to conform. Mass propaganda has the capacity to seduce an entire population into the war effort. Now, what's important is that this is the first time you have a system of mass propaganda that employs the understanding of crowd psychology, pioneered by figures like Le Bon, Trotter, and of course, Sigmund Freud. And Edward Bernays, who comes out of the Committee for Public Information, the sort of father of modern public relations, ends up, of course, working for the CIA. He does all the sort of black propaganda for the 1954 Arbenz coup in Guatemala. As well as several other interventions, you manipulate people's emotions, that people are not moved by fact or reason. Bernays, by the way, was Freud's nephew twice over through marriage. And so you have this massive propaganda apparatus cemented into place. They have speakers bureaus, three-minute men who go out and give talks at movie theaters. You have its own film division that are making movies like The Kaiser, The Butcher of Berlin. There are actually riots, you know, when these films first premiere because people are fighting to get a seat. You have its own news division, and it becomes national policy that every single publication has to support the war. So the masses shuts down. Appeal to Reason continues to publish, but has a pro-war stance. And for a window into how terrifying and effective that propaganda is, you look at the writings of Randolph Bourne and of Adams, who hold fast to the anti-war message, because what happens is this isn't used just to promote the war. It's used to destroy all of those radical movements that had frightened the robber barons and the power elite. And those who hold out, like Debs, end up in prison. Debs finally, is arrested, although, you know, he pulled 900,000 votes, 6% of the vote, is arrested and put in prison for opposing the draft. And what happens, and MacDonald writes about this, is that the moment the war is over, the dreaded Hun becomes the dreaded Red. And what you enter, in MacDonald's word, a kind of an era or a psychosis of permanent war. And MacDonald says, you know, none of the political theorists of the 19th century, including Karl Marx, grappled with this concept of permanent war, where you're constantly fighting both the external and the internal enemy. In fact, Marx doesn't write much about war, but he writes during the Prussian War, and he actually hopes for a German victory because it will, if there's a German victory, we will come closer to having the workers' state. And I think McDonald's right. So the, you know, what becomes an effective mechanism, one, by the way, which is closely copied by the Nazis. One of the seminal texts that Goebbels uses is Bernays' book, Propaganda. I mean, there's a kind of very dark irony in the fact that the work of a Bernays contributes quite directly to the murder of his own, many of his own relatives. And it becomes all about emotion and all about the manipulation of emotion. And after the war, all of these people go straight to Madison Avenue and they start working for corporations. And Laura Nader, who teaches at Berkeley and is Ralph's sister, when we had dinner a while ago, said something that I thought was very smart. She said, you know, people talk about American culture, but what they're really talking about is corporate culture. And this corporate culture was instilled, this compulsion to consume, this inner compulsion to consume, the destruction of traditional values of thrift, self-effacement, replacing it with a cult of the self, with hedonism. Malcolm Cowley, in his memoir, An Exile's Return, when he writes about the culture in mostly in Greenwich Village of the Bohemians in the 1920s and 30s, comments that although they consider themselves the Bohemians, and I think this is can be a critique as well of the Beats, is that you know, while they consider themselves outsiders, that cult of the self has infected even the left. And this coming out of the religious left, it was interesting, although I was very young, 11, 12, I was very conscious. I mean, when my father took us to demonstrations, he would wear a clerical collar. I mean, I lived in a house where there was no alcohol. We didn't work on the Sabbath. And there was great disdain for the hedonism of the new left on the part of the religious left. That was always something that made us deeply uncomfortable. And I think that when you look back at the kind of qualities that you see in the old radicals, the pre-World War I radicals like Mother Jones and others, that you can see exactly the kind of transformation that Cowley writes so eloquently about. And what happens is that, you know, in a functioning democracy, the liberal class is never designed to be the political left. It's designed to be the political center. And Chomsky has written about this, I think, quite well, that the role of a liberal class in a capitalist democracy is that it functions as a safety valve to make incremental and piecemeal reform possible. Karl Popper also makes this point in The Open Society and Its Enemies. And in fact, Popper has a great line, which I like. He says, the question is not how do you get good people to rule. Most people attracted to power are at best mediocre, which is Obama, or venal, which is George W. Bush. The question is how do you make the powerful frightened of you? And there's that wonderful scene, I think it's in Kissinger's memoirs, where it's late 1970, 71, Nixon's in the White House, there's a huge anti-war demonstration, they've ringed the White House with buses, and Nixon's standing at the window, wringing his hands, going, Henry, they're gonna break through and get us. And that's just where you want people in power to be. Right there, that's it. Conrad Black, when he writes his biography of Roosevelt, says that Roosevelt's greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And that's exactly right. That's what he did. That's what the New Deal was about. And the liberal class, as Chomsky points out, sets the parameters of the debate. So you are allowed to now, if you're, you know, let's say a Thomas Friedman, you are allowed to question the tactics or the strategy that were employed in the invasion of Iraq, but not the virtues of those who carried out the war. The same thing, and this is Chomsky's attack on people like Anthony Lewis and others after the Vietnam War. We were naive, we didn't expect the insurgency, but you can't cross that line into the virtue, attacking the virtues, questioning the system of capitalism itself. And once you do, you end up like a Ralph Nader. You are essentially, you become a pariah. You are pushed out of that system. It's that, you know, and of course what's happened, and I think, you know, Bob would agree with me on this, is that, you know, when I began as a journalist, when he began as a journalist, you know, at the LA Times, there was far more space. There was far more acceptance of a range of viewpoints. And we've just watched the walls, you know, close. You know, so that there is no place anymore for someone like me within the New York Times. It reminds me of what Dorothy Parker once said of Katharine Hepburn's emotional range as an actress. It ranges from A to B. Well, that's sort of what acceptable political opinion in America is. It's A to B. So we saw the destruction after the war. I mean, of course, the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act were used against Emma Goldman and Berkman, and the deportations, appeal to reason, even though it had supported the war, was shut down. The masses were shut down. Radical anarcho-syndicalist unions like the Wobblies were destroyed. Joe Hill, trumped up murder charges. Big Bill Haywood, again, trumped up murder charges, flees, spends the last 10 years of his life in exile in Moscow. And accompanying that is a disemboweling of liberal institutions themselves. Sidney Hook, a later figure, but becomes the kind of poster child for this. Hook had been a Trotskyite briefly, or, you know, flirted like a lot of people did with communism in the 30s when capitalism crashed. And because of that terror, he would name names within academia. This was in the 50s. You have a weakening of the liberal institutions that make incremental reform possible, and you have a destruction of those populist and radical movements that have always been the true correctives to American democracy. And Howard Zinn does a very good job in his book, A People's History of the United States, explaining precisely that, that the creation of the American political system, and this is just this deification of the Founding Fathers just absolutely mystifies me. They did not want a popular democracy. They were slaveholders. They were fervent supporters of the genocide of Native Americans. They created mechanisms by which popular rule they felt would never be achieved. Senators were appointed, and the Senate held all the power. The Electoral College, you disenfranchise women, you disenfranchise African Americans, Native Americans, people without property. So it's essentially this white ruling class, and Zinn does a very good job. I actually taught Zinn's book in the prison. It was great because nobody in the prison system reads, so I said, I'm going to teach a course on American history, and they thought that was great. And then I just brought in boxes of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States and handed them out to the inmates. It's really moving to teach these guys, and heartbreaking, because, you know, there's always four or five in any class that are so hungry to learn. And they never had a chance, ever. And you know that when they walk outside those prison doors, and they know it, they won't have a chance. They will walk back into neighborhoods, not only where there are no jobs, but where anytime they fill out an employment application to work in a warehouse, or they got to check that box that says they're a felon. They know it. And when they have that kind of knowledge coupled with that kind of hunger, it just breaks your heart. This is the third course I've taught in the prison, and they're not terribly disciplined. I mean, the first class, I think we talked more about the hood than we talked about anything else. But that idea of a colloquium and a seminar, that went out the door. And from then on, it was like 90-minute talks, and you have to raise your hand. But on the Zinn, you know, I'd be teaching it, and I'd hear these inmates go, damn, damn. We've been lied to. in this last class when I taught Litwack, that book on Jim Crow, he won the Pulitzer for After the Storm, but I think that book on Jim Crow is a better book. It's a really amazing piece of work. And just understanding the terror, you know, the reign of terror that was lynching, or the amount of rape that was carried out by both white slaveholders and white males of black women after slavery. And we were going through that chapter, and one of the inmates raises their hand and goes, "Is this why some of us are light-skinned?" And in that class, those inmates had to grapple for the first time that some of them were, of course, descended from slaveholders. Mary Chestnut, who Ken Burns quotes quite frequently in his series on the Civil War, actually writes in her diary that when she visits plantations, there were always gaggles of mulatto kids that everybody just sort of ignored. But they were all the children of the white slave owner. So the destruction of the liberal institutions, throwing people out because they're communism, which finally culminated in the McCarthy hearings. You had Elaine Schrecker's written two good books about this, by the way. No Ivory Tower on Academia, and I forget the name of the other one. But, you know, thousands of people lost their jobs. You had high school teachers, social workers used to organize the union on behalf of their clients, of course, university professors, artists, directors, Pete Seeger, you know, with the Weavers, radio personalities, journalists. I.F. Stone becomes a pariah. I can't even get a job at The Nation. And starts I.F. Stone's Weekly in the basement. And I think at that point, then just the props are knocked out from under us, because the radical movements have been destroyed in the name of anti-communism. And I'm very critical of the new left in Death of the Liberal Class, and because it doesn't finally bear any resemblance to the old radical left of pre-World War I. You know, I just did a book with the graphic illustrator Joe Sacco. It's called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. We've just spent 2 years on it. It's coming out in June. And when we began, the revolt was conjecture, but it was a belief that unfettered, unregulated capitalism knows no limits. And as Carl Pogliani writes in The Great Transformation, a really, really fine book, 1944, on what unfettered capitalism or unregulated capitalism is like, he grasps that, as Karl Marx understood, it is a revolutionary force. It in essence, commodifies everything. Human beings become commodities. The natural world becomes a commodity that you exploit until exhaustion or collapse. And Pogliani, although he's an economist, actually uses the word sacred. He said, when a society loses the capacity for the sacred, when nothing, including human life, has an intrinsic value, but only has a monetary value, that society cannibalizes itself until it dies, which is precisely what's happening. All, as Zinn pointed out in his book, every opening in American democracy came not through the formal mechanisms of power, but through movements. Whether it was the Liberty Party that fought slavery, whether it was the suffragists that fought for women's rights, whether it was the labor movement, and whether, finally, it was the civil rights movement. And you could argue that the most powerful political figure in many ways in this country, at least until he was killed in 1968, was Martin Luther King. Because when he went to Memphis or Selma, 50,000 people went with him. And with the decimation of movements and the destruction of liberal institutions. And, you know, I've taught at some of the best universities in this country, Princeton, Columbia, NYU. And Princeton is a corporation. It acts like a corporation. It thinks like a corporation. I mean, I was just at my son's graduation, and I can tell you that most of the trustee board sitting up there on the platform in their academic gowns are hedge fund managers who should be in jail. And yet they are presiding over this institution. And if you live within the confines of this institution, you're not going to speak out against corporate power and the assault on the humanities. I mean, the decimation, it doesn't happen at places at Princeton, but most kids go to Princeton to get branded, not to get an education anyway. But if you look at state universities, I mean, University of Albany abolishes its classics department, its foreign language department. I spoke at the University of Washington. They had 10% budget cuts, and their response was not to touch their gleaming sponsored business school, but to abolish the theater department and the philosophy department. All of those academic forces that have the capacity to teach you how to think rather than what to think. All of those things within the society that deal with beauty and truth and what Polanyi calls the sacred. All of those forces within the society that make transformation possible are under brutal assault. And you see it among artists. My wife is an actor. You see it among journalists. You see it among musicians. You see it among writers. You know, everybody, we don't remunerate. The only thing we remunerate are corporate management and public relations, which are lies. So with the rise of the new left, you already, I think, begin to see this disease. So you have figures in like Lane Kirkland and George Meany in the AFL-CIO who are enthusiastically backing Nixon's war in Indochina and denouncing the hippies in the street. And I was just telling you about the book when Sacco and I did this book. We wanted to write about these sacrifice zones, the poorest places in America, because in a world of unfettered capitalism, these sacrifice zones are just going to expand outwards until we create, as Ralph Nader constantly reminds us, or we are creating, a system of neo-feudalism, a world of masters and serfs, a world chronicled in, we were just talking about 1984, where you have the inner party, which is about 3 or 4%, you have the outer party, which is about 12%, and everybody else is a prole. And that's where we're headed. And so we went to Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, again, usually the poorest counties in the United States. Average life expectancy for a male in Pine Ridge is 48, which is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti, and the coal fields of southern West Virginia. And the history, the struggle of the miners, the rise of figures like Mother Jones, like John Lewis, and the fact that you can't walk into a diner or a hotel. They don't have hotel, motel lobbies or anything. All you hear is Fox News. That's it. I mean, instead of, you know, it used to be in 1912, the hero in, or the heroine in the coal fields of southern West Virginia was Mother Jones. Now it's Sarah Palin or Michelle Bachmann. And I think that the destruction of the liberal class, and Bob has just told me he's about to start a book on the Clintons, and I think we both equally loathe the Clintons. Clinton becomes, for me, the kind of poster child of that, where he speaks in that traditional feel-your-pain language of the liberal class, and yet just sells them out at every turn. And for me, Clinton becomes a very important figure in this process, whereby we create a species of absolutely hollow, what Benjamin DeMott calls junk politics, a species of political theater that is built around the personal narratives of candidates that are utterly irrelevant to the systems of power. And so you have a Clinton who begins to take corporate money and knows that if he does corporate bidding, he'll get more money. And so he passes NAFTA, which was the greatest betrayal of the working class in this country since the 1948 Taft-Hartley Act. He destroys welfare. He deregulates the FCC, which is not a small step because it allows corporations like Clear Channel and Rupert Murdoch's News Corp and Viacom and General Electric and Disney to just buy up the airwaves completely and crowd out anything other than sort of celebrity gossip and trivia and right-wing demagoguery. And of course, he decimates, along with Larry Summers, the banking system. And there is no banking crisis in Canada because Chrétien did not destroy the firewall between commercial and investment banks. There are no bank closures in Canada. And at that point, I think the game was up. I think the final sort of death blow was Citizens United, 2010. Not that corporate money at that point wasn't driving politics and driving the debate. And for me, Nader is a, you know, and if you have time, go watch that documentary they made on Nader, Unreasonable Man. It's really good. Have you seen it, Bob? It's good because they give a lot of time to Nader's critics. And they interview a lot of old Nader's raiders, who say, you know, oh, you know, and now, of course, they're pulling down lots of money in some law firm, and they're all going, you know, Ralph, you know, squandered his legacy, and of course, what they're dining out what they'd done 20, 30 years ago. Ralph remains completely consistent. In the film, they say to Ralph, they ask him that, and he said, my legacy? What are they going to do? Take seatbelts out of cars? But Ralph, I think, understands corporate power, to my mind, better than any other American in this country, and has been fighting it longer and with more integrity and courage and brilliance than any other figure in this country. In 2008, he wanted me to come to Washington. I can't stand Washington. I wasn't going to Washington. I wasn't, you know, I got kids and stuff. He wanted me to come to Washington and work with him on the campaign. And so I said, well, I'm not going to do that. But I, as my contribution to his campaign, I wrote his major policy speeches, which I have to say I thought were pretty good until I got to the University of Wisconsin and gave a talk. And a student raised their hand and said, well, we really like Ralph Nader, but every time we hear his speeches, they're so boring. But Ralph chronicles that sort of encroachment of corporate power, and he knows, you know, all of the players. And of course, I think like Bob and I, you know, Clinton becomes a very pivotal figure in that process. So that by the time we arrive to 2008, our liberal institutions have been decimated, our radical popular movements, which really are the engine of opening up our democracy. And that's the whole thesis of Zinn's book, that it was a constant battle on the part of movements to open up our democracy, that the founders of this country did not intend it to be a popular democracy. They were not sympathetic to movements. And it's that long fight. And you know, one of the things that makes Zinn's book so moving and comes, I think, out of his teaching at Spelman is that he never forgets the African-American narrative. That is just there from the beginning and throughout the entire book. And of course, you know, King, you read King in 67 and 68. There's a really, really fine biography of King called Bearing the Cross by Garrow. It's quite moving. And I just read, actually, a really fine biography of Malcolm X, written in 1965 by Peter Goldman, called The Life and Death of Malcolm X. And it's interesting that both Garrow and Goldman are white, but they get it. Goldman knew Malcolm, had covered him as a reporter in Chicago, and then had gone to New York and covered him there. But you know, that convergence, and James Cone writes about this in his book, Martin and Malcolm in America, that convergence of King and Malcolm, that understanding that white liberals were quite happy to ensure that black people would get the vote, but they were never going to do anything to lift them out of the economic squalor that had kept them trapped in these sacrifice zones or internal colonies since, of course, slavery. And this is one of the power of Litwack's book, that 40% of the population in the South is black. They build the South, literally. And yet, with slavery, they're given nothing, not even that proverbial 40 acres and a mule. Some of them were on Sherman's march to the sea, Sherman, because they were hanging on to Sherman's army and he wanted to get rid of them. But a year later, they took it all away from him. And there's really heart-wrenching stories of federal troops going in there and blacks, actually African-Americans, actually fighting the troops to try to protect their land, what they'd built, their sod huts and their crops, and of course, they're defeated. So what happens in 2008 is that at this point, the system, in my mind, is completely gamed. Wall Street pulls all of the strings. With the financial collapse, Wall Street thinks they've gotten caught. They think that the criminal malfeasance that they have engaged in, the massive fraud, the ripping off of Americans, the selling of garbage, toxic junk to foundations, institutions, colleges, pension plans, mutual funds, they think they're going to get it. I mean, they've evaporated, in many cases, 40% of people's individual wealth. They're so discredited that a figure like Barack Obama, who uses the rhetoric of accountability, of responsibility, of corporate control, assumes power. But I think Obama played a very cynical game. If you look at all of the campaign promises that he made, I don't think there's one that he hasn't broken. He's been far worse, by the way, on civil liberties than George Bush. The Espionage Act, 6 times has been used against whistleblowers and leakers. And you talk to any investigative journalist in this country, and they can't get anything because anybody within the system knows they face prison time, even if they're exposing war crimes, as the CIA agent Sterling was when he apparently spoke to Jim Risen at the New York Times. And you know, Risen was just called in the other day before a court and told the government says that he has to expose his sources, something that traditionally journalists have been protected from doing. He hasn't restored habeas corpus. The FISA Amendment Act, which retroactively makes legal what under our Constitution is illegal, the warrantless wiretapping, eavesdropping, and monitoring of tens, if not hundreds, of millions of American citizens with this new supercomputer being built out in Utah to store all the data. Unfortunately for President Obama, Section 1021 in the National Defense Authorization Act was just declared invalid by a federal judge in Manhattan, and we're waiting to see if they'll appeal. They have 60 days to appeal. But for me, Obama functioned as a brand in the same way that, you know, a few years ago, Calvin Klein and Bennington would put people of color and HIV-positive models up on a billboard to associate their product with a risque lifestyle and progressive politics. And that's why Obama won Advertising Age's top annual award, which was Marketer of the Year. He beat Apple, Zappos, Nike. And when Joe and I were beginning the final leg of this book last fall, we suddenly saw the rise of Occupy. It was clear that this revolt, this belief, and it really came out of Polanyi, this understanding that with all impediments lifted, corporations would continue to essentially cannibalize both the global and the national economy in the name of profit. I mean, anytime you see hedge fund managers taking a fervent interest in inner city education, it's not because they want to teach poor African American children how to read and write. It's because they know the federal government spends about $600 billion a year in education, and they want it, just like they want the Social Security Fund and everything else. The rise of the Occupy movement, we actually added a chapter. The last chapter will now be Days of Revolt, in the belief that it is only by rebuilding these movements that we have the capacity to confront what, in theological terms, are systems of death. It's not hyperbolic. Because what these corporations, and especially the fossil fuel industry, is doing to the ecosystem dooms the next generation. I mean, my youngest son is 4. And I'll walk by his room, and his favorite book is called Out of the Blue. And it's a big picture book of narwhals and porpoises and dolphins. And every time I see him look at those pictures, it kills me. because I know that if there is not a radical change in our behavior, every single one of those sea creatures will be dead within his lifetime. That's what they're doing. You fly over the Appalachians, which Joe and I did, and you can't understand, just like you couldn't understand the destruction of the war in Bosnia until you flew over it. I mean, you would drive through these villages, the Serbs had gone in there and driven everyone out and dynamited all the foundations, and so you'd see it, but when you flew over it in a helicopter, you just saw a completely ravaged landscape. And the same's true in the Appalachian Mountains, where the coal companies don't want to dig down anymore for the coal seams. They blow off the top 400 feet of the mountains, and they poison the water, they poison the streams. We were in towns. And by the way, when we drove through southern West Virginia, Joe and I kept feeling we were back in Bosnia because we were going into towns where all of the buildings had collapsed, a lot of them had burned, spindly chimneys, that was it. And everybody's medicated. I mean, you go into Jenkin Jones, these old coal camps, and everybody's popping Oxycontin, hillbilly heroin. But we interviewed one kid. 7 weeks later, we got a call. He died of an overdose. No fresh food. The nearest supermarket's an hour away. And when people line up, you know, same thing we were talking about with Patrick in Pine Ridge, when you go to the gas station, you only get $4 of gas. There's a long line of gas. Nobody fills their tank up. And so they're eating this processed crap. Same is true in Camden. There's no supermarket in Camden because these people can't afford fruits and vegetables that are trucked all the way over from California or up from Florida. The only thing you eat in Camden are Crown Fried Chicken and donut shops. And these corporations, you know, there's a term, business term for it. They harvest. We learn about it in the newspaper industry. You get some horrible capitalist who comes in and buys a failing city newspaper. They know it's going down. They gut it. They make it a shell. They make as much profit as they can, as quickly as they can, and then the paper dies. And what these corporations are doing, in essence, not only to the country, but to the planet, is harvesting it. And I don't know whether they're... they think they can escape from it. I had the unfortunate experience of going to a very elite boarding school on scholarship at the age of 10. So I grew up with a lot of these people. And my sneaky suspicion is that they're just stupid. They really don't think. Look at a George W. Bush. I mean, as soon as I saw Bush, I went to school with so many Bushes. The only thing they can talk about is money and how to make it. That's it. They are utterly blinded to the wider world. And of course, in biblical terms, it's called idolatry. So unless we begin to create mechanisms of resistance outside the formal structures of power, which maybe Occupy, and I was deeply enough involved in Occupy to know its many weaknesses, including the consensus model, which doesn't really work once you start hitting the numbers they hit in Zuccotti. It's interesting, the anarchist, Peter Kropotkin, who had been a natural scientist and begun his career studying like animal herds, actually writes about that. And he says that consensus usually breaks down, especially like in tribal communities, once you reach 150. And once you start reaching large numbers, then you have to break off in order to... He also has an interesting counter to Darwin in that he says, you know, it's not survival of the fittest. It's survival of those groups that cooperate. And he talks about like, you know, herds where an animal will be wounded and the other animals will circle that animal. That in fact, survival is best achieved by mutual interdependence, not survival of the fittest. And I think that, I can't tell you where the Occupy movement is going. No one knows. I've covered movements. I covered both of the Palestinian uprisings or intifadas. I covered all of the revolutions or most of the revolutions in Eastern Europe. I was in East Germany in 1989, in Czechoslovakia, and later in Romania. I grew up in a small farm town in upstate New York, and it was communist this and communist that and communist. And after a few days in Romania, I actually talked to one of my friends I grew up with, and I said, you know those things they told us about communists? They're true. If you've been in Ceausescu's Romania, But what was interesting about the movements is that even the purported leaders of these movements didn't know where they were going, ever. So you have, a few Lutheran pastors and congregants in Leipzig holding candlelit vigils against Erich Honecker and the communist state, and then, suddenly one day, instead of 70 people, it's 200 people, and then next thing you know, in September of 1989, it's 70,000 people. And Erich Honecker, this is why I've been so rough on the Black Bloc and on the tactics of violence. Erich Honecker sends down an elite paratroop division to fire on the crowd. And when the officers go in the barracks, these paratroopers are weeping because they have family members in those demonstrations. And when they actually physically get down there, but the local Communist Party refuses to give them the order to open fire on the crowd, and Honecker lasts another week in power. So when you can pull those kinds of numbers to discredit, and remember, this was the Stasi state, at the time, the most efficient police state, arguably, in the world, certainly one of them. I think there was, for every 63 East Germans, there was an informant. And it fell. It crumbled. I was with the leaders of the East German opposition on the afternoon of November 9th, 1989, and I remember them telling me that perhaps within a year there would be free passage back and forth across the Berlin Wall. Within a few hours, the Berlin Wall, at least as an impediment to human traffic, did not exist. Even they didn't know. The power of resistance. That power of resistance is potent, as Havel points out in his essay, The Power of the Powerlessness. And remember that, like the Czechs, Charter 77 fought and struggled and was marginalized for many, many years before Havel emerged in 1989. But it keeps alive that other narrative. When I was in Prague that winter, up and down the streets were posters of Jan Panic, who was a Charles University student who, to protest the 1968 invasion, had lit himself on fire and died 4 days later of his burns. When fellow university students tried to carry his body in a funeral procession to the cemetery, the police broke it up. When his grave became a shrine, they dug up his remains, cremated them, and gave them to his mother, and told his mother she was not allowed to bury them. Although it wasn't covered, although he had been rendered a non-person by the communist dictatorship, his picture was everywhere. And 2 weeks after the communist government fell, 10,000 people converged on Red Army Square to rename it Jan Panic Square. I was also in Wenceslas Square. And remember that these revolutions started pulling half a million people in Alexanderplatz in East Berlin. We're pulling half a million people in Wenceslas Square. And when you use nonviolence as a tactic, and when you speak truth to power, what you're doing is not so much confronting power, but pulling forces within the power structure to you. So that the foot soldiers, finally, who are tasked with carrying out forms of repression, are not trusted by the power elite. And at that point, the power elite is finished. And that is the route that I think that we have to follow. It was winter, it was December, it was cold, it was snowing. And a singer named Marta Kubashaya walks out on the balcony. She had sung an anthem of defiance. And the punishment for that was that when Dubček was overthrown and the Soviet client regime was reinstalled or installed in power, she became a complete non-person. Her entire recording stock was destroyed. You never heard her on the airwaves. And she had spent the time between 68 and 89 working on an assembly line in a toy factory. And she walked out on that balcony and she sang that anthem, and everyone in the crowd knew every word. That is the power of resistance. The power of truth, and ultimately, the power of faith.
You have been listening to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges speaking at the first annual Truth Dig Retreat in Santa Fe, New Mexico, courtesy of Truth Dig Radio. For further information, please contact truthdig.com. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, produced with Thiago Barroso and engineered by Michael G. Haskins and Reggie Johnson. We welcome your comments and queries with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.